This week on the Training Science Podcast, we speak with sports scientist, strength and conditioning coach, turned AI sport founder, Dr. Jake Schuster. This was a super fun conversation that revolves around how Jake transitioned from academic to practitioner to founder and CEO of the AI sports startup, Gemini. We touch on everything from defining AI to how these technologies can begin to leverage our workloads to create more time for building and fostering relationships with athletes, coaches, and management staff. There's also boatloads of inspiration for those in the trenches with an idea and a desire to become an entrepreneur one day. I know I was certainly taking loads of notes along the way as I struggle with myself in this position. Another amazing conversation with an incredible visionary that I know you're going to love. So without further ado, I now bring you Jake Schuster. Hello and welcome to the Training Science Podcast. I'm Paul Larson.
And I am Martin Buscheid.
And we're excited to be your hosts. Together, we're going to be exploring both the science of training and its application in sport.
We've spent the last 20 years researching and applying the science at the coalface of high-performance sport, from elite clubs, professional athletes, and Olympic programs.
But it's going to be here on the Training Science Podcast that we're going to take that experience and provide you with what my colleague Martin likes to call a no-bullshit approach to how we apply the science in the real world.
And because the context always matters more than the content.
So let's get into today's podcast. I'm here with Jake Schuster. Jake, welcome to the podcast.
Paul, it's great to be here.
Jake, we've just been really meeting for the first time, but we've shared some similar pathways along the traps. But maybe start with some background for me, man. And I really would love to know your interest in sport growing up. And just start there, please.
Yeah, I think like most people who ended up working in practitioner roles in sports, I was an athlete who couldn't go pro in whatever I was doing. So I wrestled and played lacrosse at the Division III level, ended up studying exercise science because I kept getting injured and wanted to figure out why. They don't really have professional careers in either of those things at the level that I was playing. So I ended up continuing my studies, went to Loughborough University for my master's in the UK, studied physiology there, and then went on to work on my doctorate in New Zealand. With the rugby teams out there, the sevens teams for the 2016 games. After that, I had a brief stint at USA Field Hockey and then went to coach at Florida State with their track and tennis and golf teams, which was a lot of fun. And from there, I left working for teams, worked for Valid Performance as their senior sports scientist, right when they were in the middle of going from a couple of founders to 50 employees in under 18 months. And it was an incredible growth experience. And then I completely burned out from moving countries every 2 years and decided to do something about this crazy idea that I had in my head.
And tell me about the crazy idea, man.
Well, when I was over in New Zealand, so I was doing force velocity and power profiling. Most people are, it's years later now, so most people are really familiar with that kind of sprint profiling. And my job was basically to make individualized programming for the athletes based on what came out. And I had to learn MATLAB and build a custom MATLAB program. I had to learn Python, and it was awful. I was awful at it. And I said, man, there's got to be a better way. And I didn't have a business idea in that moment, but I felt that pain point then. And, when I was burning out and when I was figuring out what I wanted to, do when I grew up, I recognized that there was a need across this where, to rewind for a second, when I was working for Vald, I was traveling the world visiting teams and everyone was asking for this product. I mean, people were looking at what we call an athlete management system, and like it just was not doing what anyone was asking for. I frankly think, I'm sorry, I'll say it, I don't think that industry should exist. I don't think that product line should exist, because I think if you have a decent cloud database, I think if you have someone that knows their way around Tableau or even like our Shiny apps, there doesn't need to be a product line that just does standardized descriptive statistics and dashboarding. So people were not getting what they had hoped to out of that product line. And they were asking for something that could help them do real analytics, predictive stuff with machine learning. And you don't have to always be in that advanced space, but you need to be able to manipulate data easily. And AMSs were not doing that. So I saw a need to create an entirely new product line. And lo and behold, Paul, I looked out there and pretty much the entire Fortune 500 uses products like this that are either made as generalist offerings or specifically for their industries. And like in many things, sports was 10 years behind it and had never heard of such items. So what I did is I we'll get more into it, but basically I partnered with those companies that make that tech for Fortune 500 companies and have just brought it into sports.
Yeah, that's so cool. I'm kind of reflecting on my time at High Performance Sport New Zealand, and I remember the mess of discussion around athlete management systems, right? So I'm sitting up high-ish in the, you know, as a physiology manager, physiology lead for Olympic New Zealand and stuff. And yeah, the confusion around that whole thing and the amount of money and time and resource and, pardon the French, but shit that we got out of that thing was, it was just an absolute mess. And no, I'm not really sure what we were doing. Yeah. I don't think anyone else did as well.
No, I mean, we could probably do a whole podcast about that. But I think one important takeaway from that, right, is that you can't build software that needs to be custom in a generic way, right? You have to build products in a way that people can craft it to their needs the amount that they want to, and not too much and not too little, right? And I think that that's a product line, that's an industry grouping that is generally very generic products that promises to be very customized, and you need them to be very customized for that purpose. And so most teams that I interact with now, they've built their own.
Yeah. Yeah. So I guess we're going to eventually move into the area of artificial intelligence. How do you describe AI, artificial intelligence?
Oof. You know, it's interesting, and I wrestle with this a lot because this is going to be the path for the success of my business. And I also roll my eyes at a lot of it and a lot of the things that I see and that I hear. And it's experiencing a hype wave unlike anything we've seen except for crypto a couple of years ago. Yep. And so it's the flavor of the month. And look, it's going to change our world. It's going to change our workflows. It's going to change everything around us and everything about how we do everything. But it's not there yet, and it's a ways off. And you know, the on one hand, the rate of innovation is phenomenal. We are living in times that we're going to remember. On the other hand, you know, I love that meme that says, like, you know, deep learning is here to stay, and deep learning is ready for us. And then it's a photo of a cat and the square label that says dog. And there's a lot of that out there right now.
Yeah.
So to directly answer your question, in my mind, artificial intelligence is a machine helping you do things that are not efficient for you to do. And hopefully also things that you don't have the skill set or even, you know, the computing power between our ears to do.
Yeah, for sure. And I've, you know, again, doing a little bit of homework on you, I've seen you've said it in some other podcasts. And I think you did actually mention already, but like you got to these levels with you know, trying your skills at you know, learning to code in Python and these other things, and it wasn't the easiest thing for you, right? And you might even kind of say it was a little bit of a fail. And I would say it's sort of the same thing for me. And I think probably both of us, me with Athletica, you with Gemini, it's like have better skills at getting those people around us to do that work for us, because there's some geniuses out there, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Like Matthew Lacombe and others, right? Like who have these. And sorry, I'll just take some air and mention Andrea Zignoli, who's our backend guru. It was the first time he showed me some of the things that AI can do, where we wanted, so in the endurance context, we wanted to predict oxygen uptake, VO2 during cycling, but actually do it when a cyclist was not hooked up to the machine. So what he did was he trained neural network to be able to program and compute VO2, but while the athlete was just riding the bike with power output or cadence or heart rate or respiration rate, but VO2 wasn't actually measured. So he just basically pulled that out of the equation, and it predicted it to 99% accuracy. Just and now we can do this in the field. So this is just one example of how AI, using some of these methods, machine learning, neural networks, can kind of come and do that in my field. Did you kind of experience sort of similar with your own area, Jake?
Yeah, I have. And if it's okay, Paul, I'd love to just come back a half step to your earlier comments where, you know, we're both non-technical founders. Our superpowers are finding really smart people to bring our crazy ideas to life. And I think there's a paradox there, right? Where I think knowing some kind of data technology, whether that's Tableau or Python or SQL is now table stakes for a sports scientist. I think you have to be able to visualize the work that you're doing. You have to be able to interpret and derive insights from the work that you're doing and all the data that you're collecting. If you're in the sports sciences, if you're in high performance sport, because there's a very, very strong chance that even if the team that you work for has an analytics department, that they don't have time for you. So I think that it's just like we needed Excel or to know how to use a force plate or things. It keeps moving up. At the same time, you know, I spent 6 months trying to get to a place where I could build a bar chart in Python, and that's not a great use of anyone's time. It's better if we have tech where we can just click three buttons and make a bar chart. So I think it really depends what your role is in a club and what a club is trying to generate from the staff that they resource.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah. So in terms of seeing how algorithms get magic out of the problems we're trying to solve, I think that's why my greatest interest is not really in data science or AI. It's in systems and systems architecture and systems engineering, which is really just a fancy way of saying how do organizations get things done? Because we see a lot out there on Twitter and in academic publications about, well, this deep learning model or this neural net is that much more accurate than the last one that we've created or could do this crazy sophisticated thing. Whereas just building a model that can predict how a midfielder that I want to bring from the Portuguese league into the Premier League might perform. What's the probability of them actually fitting into this league and becoming an adequate asset? That's like serious value just to build that algorithm. And a lot of teams don't have time for it, don't have the skill sets on board, don't have the infrastructure for it, don't have the systems where people would actually listen if someone came up with that. And just building out, you know, there's so much low-hanging fruit. There's so many fundamental questions that teams are trying to answer that they're not currently working on. And it could be things like, what are the biggest factors preventing us from being able to play in the style that wins in the league that we play in? And what kind of players that we can afford can get us closer to that?
Yeah, I love that. I love that you said, you know, really, you've created a system with Gemini. And again, I'm always looking at parallels with Athletica. We've created a training system, ultimately, right? For Athletica, they'll come in, they'll hook up their wearable, and they'll plug in their race date. And from just that, we now have a system that brings them to increasing their fitness, to optimize that fitness and performance potential on the race day. And that's, yeah, I guess kind of to go where we were before with the athlete management systems, like didn't really have, was it a system, AMS? I don't think it was really a system there. It was just looking at everything. It was a way to kind of hold all the data, but it wasn't actually creating any use. And it sounds like you've actually got a system where someone can kind of come in and actually make a decision at the end of the day. And it's machine intelligence leveraged at the end of the day to do that.
Yeah. When we talk about the so-called magic of AI, I think what it is helping us get closer to is information retrieval. And you might have all the information you need out there. You might not even need to make a predictive model to get to where you're trying to go. But if someone says, hey, you know, what's someone's workload ratio today? Like, how long does it take you to get that answer? And how do we solve for that? Do you have to dig through a big sheet in your AMS? Can you filter and sort the information and get there? Or can you type out freeform natural language an answer and then you get an answer that pops up to you? And so I think it's some of that crawl, walk, run of just trying to get the things that we need in our day-to-day faster.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So you mentioned natural language, and of course, we've done the same with putting that in, and again, and pretty wild. And this is the speed at which we're doing. So, you know, we're talking ChatGPT or name your large language model, right? And now we can actually leverage those tools to either add input or get an output that's being accepted and understood by the end user. So, you know, phenomenal. And when that, you know, I'm sure you must have, when that all of a sudden appeared, really, that was kind of, was that relatively breakthrough for your business at Gemini? Hey, athletes and coaches, are you ready to dive deep into the science of training? We've got something special lined up for you. Welcome to our new Athlete Profiling Primer mini course. What is the Athlete Profiling mini course? Well, it's a groundbreaking free email course designed by Martin and I to give back to the field that we're so passionate about. In only 5 days with this course, we unlock for you the secrets of speed and power profiling that, quite frankly, many top-level sports scientists and practitioners are only beginning to explore. Each day, we dive into essential topics, from building effective profiles and matching them with targeted training strategies, to predicting performance in real time. This isn't just theory. It's about giving you the tools to apply these insights directly to your training regimen. And getting started couldn't be simpler. Just visit athleteprofilingprimer.com. Enter your email and you're enrolled instantly. The next morning, your first lesson lands straight into your inbox. And you might ask, well, why are we giving away such valuable insights for free? Well, it's because we truly believe in the power of this knowledge to transform athletic training. And we want you to experience these benefits firsthand. Once again, just go to athleteprofilingprimer.com, enter your email, and you're instantly enrolled in our course. It's that easy, and it's a true game changer. So go take our course and tell us what you think. And now, back to the podcast.
Yeah, I think we've had to wait until that tech has developed a little bit, where both the large language models improved, but also the modularity of those products has as well, both being able to work with tabular data, not just text data, but also being able to put them on top of your own database, which there's been an explosion. You've seen Databricks and Snowflake both release products that can do that kind of thing recently. And it helps that we're in the startup program of both. We're built on top of both. So we get access to those things early. So they're already in use cases with some of our customers today, even if they're not in our public product quite yet. So we're seeing all that. The resounding answer is yes. I think the questions become, how do you thread the needle of useful versus gimmicky? And then how do you create a set of shared expectations around both the accuracy of the outputs and also the necessary humans in the loop and how much you have to train the model and train the model on your data set and on the SQL questions that it might be generating in order to get a really useful feature set. You know, I was at an AI conference in San Francisco last week for a company called Weights and Biases that we love. And it was pretty much a who's who of NVIDIA and Meta and Google and everyone coming up and saying, well, my model's better. My model's better. And the most interesting comment in the whole conference was from the guy at Snowflake Data Cloud. And he said, look, we have whipped this model to death and layered it on different things. And it's 76% accurate. But a business user needs 99%. And who are we to convince them that 76 is acceptable? And how do we get them to use this product and not freak out every time there's a hallucination or a slight, you know, inaccuracy? And I don't think any of us know the answer to that.
Yeah, I know. I would say our users are, from Athletica's standpoint, they're pretty forgiving as an end user because it's never been something that's been there before. And it's in the early phases, so they recognize that it can hallucinate from time to time. We have a feedback sort of phase as well, where they can kind of, you know, give it a thumbs up or a thumbs down. But yeah, no, I hear you, and it is still sort of early days, but it's still fascinating nonetheless to see, even at 76%, it's still a wow factor to me. Like it hits it more often than it doesn't. You know what I mean?
Yes. Yeah. And I think we just have to question what's more important, the usability or the accuracy. Can we tolerate that once a week it might give you a list of players and one of those players actually doesn't exist?
Yeah. Fair enough. So, we're kind of going all over the place, but, you know, we're ultimately talking about, Moneyball on steroids, I guess. And this is really what, you know, your product at Gemini is trying to do, right? Like you're trying to give the underdog the advantage for things that are in the space of trades, transfers, talent ID, and tactics, right? Is that the bulk of the offering that you're trying to do with Gemini?
It is. And I think we're ultimately solving for two problems. And I'll give the boring one first. Most sports teams don't also want to be software companies. And I understand completely that everyone wants to and probably should have their own internal web app. That's their unique thing for their unique business users. But there's a lot of hires that have to be made just to even get to a starting point of using all the data that you have. And some of that's data engineering. Some of that's just the thing we always talk about, that's getting all your data in one place in an organized way that stays updated. That's a huge pain. And most teams don't want to have to hire data engineers. They're really expensive. And you probably need three before you even get to where you're trying to go with all the data that we have right now. And then you have to actually set up an environment where people can do machine learning. And most teams employ really business analysts. They're not machine learning engineers. So if you want to build machine learning models, it might be one at a time throughout the year for really, really specific projects. So to be able to iteratively ask predictive questions is not possible in 99.9% of sports teams out there. So we're helping to automate or abstract away a lot of the most tedious parts of the process to organize data and create an environment in which machine learning can be done. And then the second thing that we solve for is create some accessibility or some democratization for what you would call the business user, for an AGM, a scout, a VP, someone who makes big decisions about roster and on-field happenings. And so that was my original vision, right? Is just to bring that to people who aren't data scientists. And so by solving that kind of one-two, what we're doing is we're helping teams accelerate their maturation, where the vast majority of analytics departments are three people at most. The LA Dodgers of the world are the exceptions, but most teams getting a cloud database well set up would be a huge win for them. And so if we can do that in a day for them, because we've set it up to be semi-automated, and we save them a year of work and an additional hire, and all of a sudden the people that they serve, their stakeholders, are getting answers a lot faster, we feel that that's a core part of the puzzle. That it's not build versus buy. It's not doing it yourself versus buying it off the shelf. You kind of should do both. It's not hiring versus technology. You should have both. We just fit into that triangle of people, processes, and technology.
Yeah, it's phenomenal. Yeah, you're really equipping those without the skill sets to be empowered ultimately to make these kinds of analyses. And just at their fingertips too. So I've been online, and I think I watched one of your presentations. I think it was from last year. Sorry, I forgot the tech conference. It was on, found you on Google. But basically, like you actually showed how the process worked, where you're actually able to click and drag in your various different numbers and trades. Do you want to give an example, maybe from the trade standpoint, like how would someone actually start to input data from a trade standpoint, and what would they get out?
You okay if I use like transfer market and soccer as an example?
Of course, yes.
So most teams want to identify a certain playing style that they can, create and stick to. So most soccer teams around the world want to identify the common playing styles around both the world and their league in particular, and then figure out how far off they are from using that playing style in an accurate and consistent way and doing it effectively. And then they need to find a list of players that they can buy that are in their price range that fulfill the characteristics or the traits that make up that playing style in a way that they're currently lacking. And so that kind of 3-4 part story is really just a clustering analysis followed by a regression model, maybe with a time series where you can identify which players you could resell for more money in 3 years or so. And that requires 6 weeks each from a machine learning engineer that most teams can't afford. So someone who's a lot less technical can go in, hook up their data set or their data sources to a database through us, and then begin to immediately query, asking those questions and building models doing that. And they all have the data. They all have the third-party data, and then their first-party, either first-party data or things like, player profiles, positional profiles, where they know exactly what they want, but it's not represented statistically and it's not run against the data that they have. So we just allow them to do that a lot more quickly.
Yeah. Well, amazing. Yeah. So yeah, think of that's just incredible. Like, how much money and time did you just save someone? Right? Like, that's up there. Like you just kind of brushed that off. But like, think of how long that would have saved and time that and money and whatnot. That's even a few years ago, right? There's just no way that was there.
Yeah, Paul. I mean, it's funny because look, I want to be clear. Like the teams have the subject matter experts, and the teams have, you know, both in soccer and in how to understand what they want from the players and from the team. And these teams are full of incredibly brilliant people who are analysts who are trying to help bring data-driven answers, right? Sure. Or influence data-driven decisions. But analysts who work at Google, analysts who work at Tesla, they've got millions of dollars worth of platforms supporting them as tools to answer the questions that their stakeholders have for them. They are not doing everything by hand in Python and SQL. And that's what people at sports teams are doing. So we're just trying to help them move the ball down the field a bit.
Incredible. Well, what else, before I move away from Gemini, what else do we need to know about it?
You know, I think that it's funny. There's this paradox where people recognize that they want to do things faster, and they recognize that they want to do things easier, and they generally understand the value of different tools. Even people who want to do everything by hand in code, they download new coding packages, new windows, new programs to do what they're doing faster. But on the flip side, people really only care about the case studies and the use cases, as they should. They don't care that the model is 3% more accurate. They care if they can buy a better player. They care if they can outsmart their opponent on Saturday. And so I think maybe rather than answering your question, I'm sharing one of the paradoxical challenges of business. But I think, you know, there are a lot of smart people out there selling their services to build algorithms and to provide professional services saying, well, I can build the transfer market model. I can build the free agent model. That's great. But we play in a space of recognizing that the people who work for the teams are the subject matter experts, and they should be equipped to do their job as quickly and easily as technologically possible. If they want to seek outside help for the answers, they can go to someone else. We're here to provide tools.
Nice. So let's go back a bit. We were going to talk a little bit about entrepreneurship, which we both experienced. And, you know, I found your story evolution sort of story interesting as well, in that you moved into entrepreneurship because you were burnt out, at least at one stage. And I would just kind of argue that you can get burnt out leading a team as an entrepreneur as well. So, but how did that all kind of come about? And tell us about your journey about being an entrepreneur. You know, it's not always successful, and there's trials and tribulations along the way.
Well, you said you can get burnt out as an entrepreneur. No, you will. but I think being burnt out as a practitioner is what led me to this journey. And although the challenges of entrepreneurship, I will admit this is harder than anything I've ever done before in my life, it is also more fulfilling. So we'll get into that part. But part of high performance sport, unless you're really, 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 really good at it, which I wasn't, is going to be moving jobs every couple of years for the next adventure. And part of that means you don't really have a chance to grow up. And I probably had the maturity of a 24-year-old at 30, and I realized I had to make a change in my life. And in parallel, I just happened to be incubating this idea in my head. And so, look, there were five people that I met at the gym in Miami who I had told about this idea. And at some point, they all conspired and said, look, we'll each give you $10,000 if you go full-time on this idea. And so I did. And that money, man, it was used to pay rent for the first while, and to hire someone to help with taxes and register the business and make a pitch deck and make a really ugly prototype. And, you know, at one point I was fundraising angel investors just to work with a design agency to survey my friends on what they wanted and then make some design mockups. And then I spent 6 months pitching VCs on those design mockups and the concept to fund the business, to be able to hire the engineers who could build the V1. So I think, you know, we made a press release last week about a new investor that we got, and, you know, everyone's slapping me on the back and acting like everything's so rosy. And I mean, they don't see that part of the journey, right? So I pitched 43 venture capitalists before I got a yes. And then there were two that had said, well, we're in if this group is in. And that group said no for about 6 months before they said yes. And then they finally did. And then I got the other two groups in. And that was the beginning, right? So that was the beginning. That was almost 8 months after I went full time. So that was step one. And then I could hire some engineers who would build the minimum viable product. And then, like every business, right, what we built, no one actually wanted, and it didn't actually work. And we had to start all over, and, you know, a number of disasters along the way. And then those engineers quit because they had higher paying, more stable jobs. And that's how it goes. And, you know, you find the next engineers who have a bit more scar tissue and are up for the battle. And then we finally managed to raise a seed round, which is basically, you know, what you call the first institutional investment, putting a price valuation on the business in August of this year. And that brought the total number of sports team owners that had invested in us to 9. And then this recent one has 18 sports team owners making up the fund. But, you know, we'll click into any level of detail you want on that. But that's just a long-winded way of saying, if you've got any real traction less than 2 years after starting, you've gotten lucky.
Yeah, no, it's awesome. I'm in awe of your success. And I'm also laughing about the you know, the VCs that are saying, well, I'll say yes if they say yes, because it's it's such a I don't know, an emotional, it seems like it's an emotional decision making matrix that investors will act on, as opposed to logic sometimes. But anyways, we certainly haven't been as successful as you. So just my hat's off to you. And congratulations on all of that. It's a bizarre world.
I appreciate that immensely. I think others would say I took the easy way out by you know, finding, you know, venture capital funding and taking dilution on the ownership. Bootstrapping is harder, and you know, you're gonna see the results of that in the end game as well. So I think it's just two different paths, you know?
Yeah.
I think one thing that, just to layer on that, that's funny and terrifying is, you know, the next stage, Series A, that's where they invest based on your revenue numbers. Seed is where they explicitly and publicly say that they're investing in the founder and they're investing in the idea and whether they believe in what you can create. And that's like absolutely terrifying. And so there's a lot of cliches out there about the person that entrepreneurship forces you to become is like the best value, the best output. But it's really true, because I feel like every 3 months I'm getting a new MBA on some topic, and that might be fundraising, it might be go to market, it might be HR, it might be tax compliance. But what that first 8 months especially taught me, it's they're skills for life.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no doubt. It's incredible, actually, when you think about your skill set. Like, you're not trained in this at all, right? Like, go back to your background. You're completely, you know, sports science, PhD, and then, you know, embedded within sport. Where's your business skill learning? Like, yeah. It was non-existent, right? So you've learned it all.
I'm a knuckle-dragging strength coach. Everything that I do, I'm doing for the first time.
Yeah, but that's amazing, and a real testament to you, Jake, and also the fact that, you know, you, for the listener out there, this should be inspiring to them too. Like, it's anything is possible as well, right? We can learn anything. Not that it's easy. but yeah, it's incredible.
I appreciate that a lot, Paul, and I'd love to echo that in terms of, I didn't know how to interview a software engineer or how to figure out if they were any good. I didn't even know the names of the coding language that they were talking about. And same goes for a salesperson. How did I know if a software salesperson, you know, had any idea what they were doing? And those are all things that I had to, you know, either outsource or hack, figuring out how to do, and lots of trial and error. And that's just part of what it takes. And yeah, I would echo, if I can do it, definitely anyone else can.
So when I'm doing a lot, we're in the small seed sort of stage, which is great for us. And we're doing a little bit of HR. We have to interview people and stuff. So tell me what your process is, if you can share, on making decisions about hiring, especially developers who, you know, again, you might not know their language and the skill set, but what do you follow?
Yeah, a couple of keys. So the first thing is, you have to sell someone on the vision. And I would actually be really wary of hiring anyone that you don't have to do that with. You know, at a certain stage, there's a lot of people have said a version of this, like, the best people aren't available. They're not applying for jobs. You have to go find them. They're happy where they are, and you have to convince them. I don't know if that's true when you're super early, but I would say that almost anyone who's worthy of the caliber that you probably want to hire for, the first thing that you have to do is sell them on the vision. And if they don't insist on talking to the founder, it might not be a fit. And so once you've done that, you need to flip it, because everyone I mean, this generation, it's almost like professional athletes and how well they are trained for the media and interviews now. Everyone can give a great interview. Everyone will tell you what you want to hear. Everyone will say how good they are at that thing that you're asking them about. Don't waste your time on any of that. Do behavioral interviewing, which is just ask questions, you know, where you require them to frame examples or to talk through certain scenarios, how they would handle a certain situation, an example of when they did something, like, you know, an example of when you disagreed with your boss about how something should be done and how you handled it and what the outcome was. What's an example of when you had to do a project that you didn't think was important to the company roadmap and how you navigated your way through that? You know, what's an example of when you had a disagreement with a colleague that you were collaborating with on a project, you know, things like this. Because if someone gives a really fluffy, nonsensical answer, you're gonna figure it out pretty quickly. And sometimes you have to ask the same question three times before you get the honest answer, the answer with any color to it. So I would encourage just asking the same thing multiple ways. The other thing is talk to references very early in the process, because I think you can build this really false case for a candidate where they've talked to multiple members across the hiring committee who all think that they're a really swell person with great energy and a CV that makes a lot of sense. And you're all wrong. Talking to a reference as early as possible is important, I think. And the tricky part is, because of the litigious society that we live in, no reference is ever going to say anything awful about someone, especially if not if they're listed by the candidate. But what you can do is ask them, if this person failed in this role, why would that happen? Or when this person struggled when they were working with you, why was that? And what did that look like? And you can get them to tell stories that will reveal the things that you should watch out for. The other thing I would say it's going to sound really cliche, but we'll all learn it the hard way, is hire the best human being that you can find, because we can all fall in love with a resume, what someone represents on paper. I find it's really hard to not be almost romanticized by what someone could do for your business in terms of optics. You know, oh, hiring this person is going to look really good. That's going to be a big splash when they announce that they're working for us. Yeah, the next day, then you have to get to work together. You have to be in the trenches together. And that press release is not going to matter anymore. So hire the best moral, you know, ethically aligned person that fits the culture you're trying to build. I think it's Amazon who talks about, you know, does someone raise the bar or just meet the bar? Is someone going to actually improve your culture? Is someone going to challenge you all to raise your level? And that's really easy to say, but I find it just matters over and over and over.
Yeah, it's awesome, Jake. I can see why your investors invested in you, because you just exemplifying the importance of the human connection. And, you know, if you're the CEO and the founder, people are going to, they're going to follow that, and they are going to buy into your vision. And man, I mean, again, this is, it's just like, I really appreciate the lecture that I was just given right in the, we're in a key hire right now. And to this point in Athletica, every single member of the team comes from Hit Science. They know about Hit Science. They've got the book and they've taken the course. They understand the vision completely, and they come in and, you know, we're bootstrapped. And a lot of them, most of them have worked for free at some stage for it, because they buy in. And we're looking potentially right now at a shiny light but no experience or buy-in necessarily. And that's, you know, that's you've really helped me right now, right here in this call, to know my decision. So just, I really appreciate that one, man.
I appreciate you saying it. Look, a couple of things. Two of my senior staff, I spent more than a year and a half convincing to join. So just because someone isn't bought in today doesn't mean they won't become, you know, that way. But I think, you know, separate that from the person that they are, because that's key. You know, and what you said, I really appreciate your comment, but that's only because I've been willing, you know, to make every mistake under the sun. I think, like, we're all going to learn these lessons the hard way. And I think something that a very close advisor said to me actually the other day is, CEOs are not in the business of people. They're in the business of business. Like, that's paradoxical to how some of the greatest skill sets that we have to build. I mean, you would have had it a lot earlier than me because of the roles you've had, is understanding how to work with different people and get the best out of different people and understand different people and different communication styles and so forth. But at the end of the day, we can't afford to have someone that slows everyone else down. we can't afford to have someone that we're all wasting bandwidth on trying to figure out how to get the best out of them or trying to get along with them. That we don't have time for that in the businesses that we're trying to run. And so being really honest with ourselves about that kind of thing, it's hard, but it's necessary.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. There is a fine balance there. And I'm thinking again, if I was a good leader in my Olympic roles, it was because of the connections that I had with my team, which I still try to, in building Athletica and Hit Science, that's what I still, all of us, I think, exemplify. But yeah, it's an important mention that actually I'm no longer CEO in my company. So that's actually it's been very helpful. I'm the founder, but I hired a CEO. So
congratulations.
Well, thanks. No, Mark's been absolutely a godsend because I don't have that. You kind of mentioned the hard-nosed kind of rule, right? And he delivers those, which is really helpful for me because it is something that I lack that objectivity, sort of time to make the hard decisions in the company, which has really saved us in various times.
No, I mean, I think it's key, right? That's one of many reasons I brought on our chief operating officer, Alec Coughlin, because he looks at so many things so very differently from I, and it's great because we can approach those things objectively.
Yeah, well, the other reason for me too is I don't have the time, the bandwidth to do things like legal and accounting and all the things that are involved with investment, and the list is so long. And if I'm building a product, that's not going to be helpful if I have to deal with that. So I mean, there's so many different things. Man, this has been such a cool conversation for me, Jake. And great, Jake. So one more question before we call it a day is now that you're well removed from, the industry as a practitioner, but you still have a lot of friends in it and you can look back without bias, what patterns have you seen? And, what do you think that practitioners should be focusing on and doing today in the technology era that we're in?
Yeah, I used to spend so much time focusing on the most incredibly cool details of training programs that I was writing. It felt like trying to write a symphony, trying to, mind you. But I think any practitioner that's honest with themselves knows that compliance and adherence are probably too low to see real efficacy. I'd say the possible exception are like endurance athletes, and then they have their sessions that they run. But even so, in the weight room especially, compliance is so low that I don't think the physiological effects that we think we're creating are really happening on the level of detail that they might. And so that's a way of saying, I think more important than those details are, have you built strong enough relationships with the technical coaches to create buy-in and system integration of what you do in the bigger picture? Have you built strong enough relationships with the veterans in the locker room so that they can lead as much compliance as possible, so that they can get the kids into the weight room with them? Are you becoming a part of that sport practice, right? If we agree, one of the few tick boxes that we know just has to be in every training program, and I'm thinking about team sport athletes, is exposure to max speed running, right? Every 5 days, they've got to touch that 90%+. Do we know if it's 85 or 95? No, we don't. Do we know if that number exists for every athlete? No, we don't. But we know it's out there. So if we think we have to have that, earning your 5 minutes, your 15 minutes in the sport training session to be able to hit that is the most important thing you can do. It's not arguing for the physiology of it. It's not designing 85 versus 90. It's becoming a part of the team enough to actually run that module in practice. And I could kind of go on, but I think you get the point. It's some of those soft factors that create your place in the system rather than the details of the training program. And the coaches that I really admire that really felt like they made a difference in our industry, they're not the ones with the most complicated science. They're the ones that were really a beloved part of the teams that they worked for. And I got that all wrong when I was a practitioner, but I learned from some great coaches who did that really well. I'll pause there. I think that there's a lot of things I could touch on, like, isometric training's great. Yeah. Like I think everyone's gotten around on that topic now, right? I think that there's a lot of things that frankly, I see some of my friends on Twitter and I'm like, we're still talking about that stuff. I just can't believe the full circle that we come on some of these topics. And take care of the big rocks, you know, take care of people's hamstrings, make sure that they're, you know, having an appropriate training load balance and hit your high speed running and then move on to the other stuff.
Yeah, brilliant. Are you familiar with Professor John Keeley?
I love John. He's the man. I actually saw him in Spain last year. We were both at an event and ran into each other. He's like one of the best humans in this industry.
He's amazing. So he was on the podcast, but that was really what the podcast was kind of all about, was just the, you know, and here's a guru in the whole, the sports sciences and these sorts of things. He's definitely earned his respect from a publication standpoint and his knowledge of periodization, et cetera. But he was basically just, you know, saying the same thing that you are right now, is like, what about buy-in? What about belief? You know, these are the key things. And so it's like establishing relationships with your athletes and people. This is really, but you know, we're talking about AI, but we're also coming back to the critical aspect of relationships across your team, across the athletes, you know, all these various different links.
Yeah, and this is where it's at, right? Like people might roll their eyes at some of those comments from myself or from John, but it's correct. And I was interviewing on our podcast the other day a couple of really, really top heads of analytics, so to speak, at their teams, and they said their KPI is touch points. How often does the sporting director interact with their work? And I think, you know, a proxy for that could be, how many times throughout the year does someone walk into the weight room? Doesn't matter if they're there for 15 minutes or 90 minutes. I mean, it does, but it might matter more how many times in the year they were in there. And again, I'm thinking more about team sports and even look for endurance athletes. I know there's stereotypes of resistance to weight training. Like, how many times throughout a calendar year of training and competition have they walked inside the weight room? Is anyone measuring that? And year over year improvement, and how much of the squad is getting in there a certain number of times. Like, let's look at that.
For sure. But this is a little bit where the field of AI, technology, whatever you want to call it, can come to the party and assist the practitioner to give them more bandwidth to feed into the things that humans are good at, and that's making these relationships. This is what we're arguing with Athletica Coach Version, is that let us do some of the minutiae with your programming. Machines can do a pretty darn good job of making a periodized plan for you, and then you go and execute that with your athlete and talk to them and make those relationships and get that buy-in and get that belief. And what a potential combo 1-2 punch that you could be.
Yeah, and it's all about shifting workflow. All of this is about shifting workflow, right? What you said, you know, a decent program can be created by a machine now. Awesome. What does that mean? It means that the person who would have been doing all that work can focus on the things that you mentioned, but also on the details, right? And again, it's kind of like, you know, everyone thought that the ATM was going to put bank tellers out of business. No, now the bank tellers get to focus on more important and interesting and sophisticated work. And there's thousands of examples like that. And I think whether you call it a semantic layer or abstraction or automation, everyone should be interested in the most tedious parts of their work being automated away so that they can focus on other things.
Yeah, totally. So, I mean, I think that's a pretty awesome note to leave it on, that we both believe in the work that we're doing. Jake, it's been an absolute honor to be coached by you in this session. Thank you so much. And where can people learn more about you and what you're doing?
Well, I'm at Jake at Gemini Sports with an S at the end .ai. And that's the URL that you can find us at. And I want to reciprocate that, Paul. Huge fan of your work. Always have been. Huge respect to any fellow entrepreneur and to anyone listening to this. Like, just go do it. Take that leap of faith, keep going, push way further and way harder than you think you're capable of, because anyone can do this. It's just about willpower.
Yeah, man. Super, super inspiring. Jake, on behalf of Martin, my team, and the whole Hit Science team, all the best with your continued work at Gemini, and until the next time.
Thank you so much, Paul. Looking forward to helping each other.
Hey there, training science enthusiasts. If you like what you just heard, be sure to follow us on Instagram and Twitter at Hit Science to keep up with our latest. And if you want to take your knowledge to the next level, visit our website to check out our full online course and textbook on the science and application of high-intensity interval training. Now, if you're a university, club, or sports organization, we've got special packages available for you and your team. Just contact us at info@hitscience.com. And if you want to join our evolution as a field and take your application even further, be sure to check out the HIT Science technology platform, Athletica. Visit athletica.ai or follow us on Instagram and Twitter @athletica_AI. Thanks for listening.